You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
15 years ago, sex work was decriminalised in New Zealand, and if the number of sex workers hasn't necessarily decreased, the industry has become much safer. It's also changed dramatically. Street-based work and massage parlours have almost disappeared, while independent work has become the new normal. With decriminalisation, a whole underground world and culture has mutated and is somewhat dying. It's this world, more so than the contemporary one, that oral historian Karen Wilton spent 8 years looking into. In her book My Body, My Business, beautifully illustrated by Madeleine Slavik, Wilton lets 11 sex workers from all walks of life share their intimate stories. I wanted to ask Karen about the premise of her work, so I read the first line of her book, which perfectly encapsulates her intentions and the result of her work. So you say, I have often thought of the world of sex work as a world apart, a separate secret world that can only be entered by those who, as in a fairy tale, have been given the special key or who know and utter a secret word. And then the walls dissolve, the curtains are pulled back, and the secret world is revealed as not so secret after all, as just another part of this world, just the breath or a step away, just next door, just ordinary and yet not. This idea of unveiling a world you and I suppose most people in general see as mysterious and covet, was that the intent of your book and the interviews?
It was partly the intent of my book. Yeah, I mean, I suppose to kind of almost normalise the world of sex work a little bit, you know. People really see it as a very separate kind of a world. And people who have nothing to do with it often don't really know anything about it. And, I mean, and sex work are all over the place, right? People who've done sex work are part of our communities. They might be your neighbour, they might be your work colleague, they might be your family member, but they might not ever tell you that they've done it because it's still so stigmatised. And so because of that, information about the world of sex work isn't really available. Yeah.
Because you also say that in the process to kind of approach this work, you had this, I guess it stems from curiosity, and then you kind of had to push the door to get in and then realise that it wasn't actually that hard to get access to it.
Well, I knew some people who had worked in the sex industry back in the day. I had had friends who'd worked in massage parlours in the 80s. People around the scene I lived in 1980s Wellington, some people there had worked in massage parlours. And I had known Catherine Healy a long time ago as well, Catherine Healy of the Prostitutes Collective. And so I contacted Catherine and asked her if she thought it was a good idea to start doing some oral history interviews with people from the industry, and she did. And so she started putting me in touch with people. I suppose for me, the transgender community was a group of people that I hadn't really had much to do with before, and I was a little bit shy about, oh, will they accept me? Will they feel okay about me? What if I say something wrong or get something wrong? But actually, they were very, very warm and welcoming, the people that I interviewed from the trans community, and kind of put me onto their friends a bit and things. I felt a bit like I felt able to trust me because I came recommended by someone else that I'd interviewed, you know, because I'd interviewed their friend, or Catherine Healy had said that I'd interviewed her and that she'd enjoyed doing the interview and everything.
Maybe because there's this sort of wire kind of thing going on where people, especially when it comes to transgender people, there's a lot of lack of understanding, and so people kind of have these preconceived ideas and come in to ask questions that are just not the right ones. I don't know. I feel like a lot of people are only interested in like the genitalia part of transgenderism and ask all these very private questions, like very intrusive.
Yeah. Kind of questions. I mean, no one ever comes and asks me about my genitalia. You know, yeah. the focus on that kind of thing with trans people. It's awful.
So you're an oral historian. You've kind of touched on how you got to do these interviews, but can you explain to me and our listeners the sort of exact process that you went through with these interviews and kind of like the whole process from doing these interviews years ago to the final product, which is the published book today?
Yeah, well, I typically would sit down with somebody with an audio recorder and a couple of lapel mics pinned onto both of us and record hours and hours and hours of interview. The first interview that I did, I didn't really realise how exhausting it was going to be. And so I interviewed Anna Reid for like, it was like 5 hours. And we were both just about dead by the end of it. And after that, I thought, oh, she was in Christchurch. I'd gone down to Christchurch to interview her. So I sort of had to do it all in one day. I was only there for one day. But after that, I started, if I was going to another centre to interview somebody, I would stay overnight and do it in two parts. And some of the longer interviewees, like Dana DeMello, who's a beautiful transgender woman who passed away earlier this year, very sadly, she her interview is about 18 hours long or something. Mm. She and I lived in the same suburb in Wellington. And so I would just pop up to her house every, I think it was every Tuesday lunchtime or something, and we'd do a couple more hours because she'd lived a very interesting life and she was amazingly talkative as well, really. So some of the interviews were really very long. They're audio interviews. And then I would write up like a time-coded abstract of them to be deposited in the Turnbull Library with them.
Yeah, you say something interesting as well about memory and how, I guess, do you think it's better to kind of like come back to it later because some memories tend to resurface after you've kind of like forced them back to the surface?
Yeah, I really found, especially if I was interviewing people like 2 days in a row, people would have remembered all kinds of things, you know, because sometimes they were revisiting events of 30 or 40 years ago, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you know, stuff that they hadn't necessarily thought about for a long time. And so, yeah, sometimes the next day they would have remembered all these things, dreamt about things in the night. Yeah.
So there's a great variety of experiences and stories and backgrounds that you have in the stories that you've shared. You did more interviews. So I think you did 19 interviews in total.
That's right.
But there's 11 in the book.
Yeah.
But you have transgender people that belong to the LGBTI community. You've got, you know, straight cisgender people. You've got Pakeha. You've got Māori people. You've got street-based workers, people that have worked in parlours, people that have worked independently. People from a different age range as well. Were you trying to be as exhaustive as possible? Like, how did you process with the editing of these stories and choosing what was going to make the cut, I guess, the final cut in the book?
Yeah, I mean, that was really important to me in terms of choosing who to include in the book, was to have a range of different experiences. People who had worked in different areas of the industry, people in different locations, different parts of New Zealand, people with different class backgrounds, you know. I mean, definitely some of the interviewees were from, like, working class kind of backgrounds and their options had been limited, but other people were quite middle class or had university degrees, you know, had careers already and decided to change and do sex work instead. So sorry, I'm not really answering your question.
No, that's good. I was just wondering the idea was to like break down stereotypes, I guess. Like, we tend to think of, I mean, I think people in general tend to think of sex workers as people that have had like an abusive background or that come from a place of very little money, not educated, started very young or something. But then the stories that you share show that, you know, you don't have to have that background to be a sex worker. And then sometimes people do, and then sometimes they don't.
That's right. I mean, a couple of the interviewees talked about being sexually abused when they were kids. Some people deliberately stressed that they hadn't been sexually abused when they were kids, that they'd had really safe, loving family environments. And, you know, some of them wanted to kind of set that misconception right about the idea that everyone in the sex industry has been abused. So people go into it for a real mix of reasons. Some people, one woman went into it, she and her girlfriend went into it to save up to go on a trip to London.
Yeah, even the aspect, the money aspect, I guess, is quite different for everyone, where some people do it. I think, you know, Anna Reid kind of does it more because she sees that as a relationship and not so much for the money, whilst others do it kind of solely for money. But again, there's a variety of situations, and it's good that you get to show that you shouldn't reduce sex work to a certain life. I can't find my words anymore. You know, that there's not one way to get into sex work and one background that is common to everyone.
I think there's a huge range of experiences, actually. Yeah, and I mean, Anna, it's interesting that you raise Anna, because Anna's quite an unusual story, because she sort of giving love to people. She has kind of a Hindu guru, and she sees sex workers give it as giving love and sharing love with people, and she really enjoyed it sexually. She talks about sex work. It was just made for me, she says.
Yeah, which is...
But other people had much more mixed feelings about
yeah.
it. I didn't talk to anybody who saw it as slavery and hell or anything mm. like that. But, you know, people, like with any job, people do it for the money. In a lot of, you know, mainly when people are working, they're doing it primarily for the money in a lot of cases. And that's true yeah. of the sex industry as well. I mean, some people had quite mixed feelings about doing it. Some people got quite burnt out, quite over it, and eventually wanted to stop. I remember Kelly talked about it being quite hard to get out of the industry
mm.
because she's like, what do you put on a CV? What do you tell people that you've been doing for the last 15 or 20 years?
Well, that's something that I wanted to stress on, actually, because, again, I think Anna says that, she says at the end, which I thought was very powerful, at the end of the interview that you've edited, she says, I look forward to the day when you can apply for a job and you can say to your prospective employer, I worked at such and such a parlor, brothel for 5 years, and that person can see the assets rather than, oh my God, we're not going to have someone, anyone like her here. And it's really, I think it says a lot that we still don't see sex work as something that can bring you actual assets like being good yeah. at communicating or whatever. Like, it's just another job. You learn skills that you can yeah. apply to other things. But
yeah.
so
yeah.
it seems like...
I mean, I love that quote from Anna. And I often think that sex work has it has things in common with other jobs, like being a massage therapist, mm. you know, or nursing, or, you know, there are other jobs where there are similarities to sex work. But sex work... people are still seen as outside the pale of it, I think, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
it's still 15 years on from decriminalisation, unfortunately, there's still a lot of stigma attached to it. And, it would be a fairly brave person, I would think, who would put on their CV
mm.
that I worked at blah, blah, massage parlour for 5 years, and this has given me really good communication skills, really good understanding of body language, really got, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it not being dismissed by prospective
yeah.
employer.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's it, because it has been 15 years now since decriminalisation.
Mm.
And you would think that in the course of these 15 years, the view on sex work would have changed. But it seems like it does seem like it's more accepted in general, I say overall. But at the same time, it's not really... things have not been... made to make it that much easier, though, to get out of sex work and transition into another job that you'd want to have. And you point that out in your book as well, in the preface again, where you say that it's quite it's quite ironic because the abolitionists are saying, you know, are urging sex workers to get out of sex work, but also not really doing anything for them to have. Find an environment afterwards where they can keep working?
No, and I mean, if people continue to stigmatise sex work, then actually it makes it harder for people to get out of sex work. So it is ironic, really.
Yeah, because you also present them as victims and people that are never consented to work in that industry to begin with, and that's not helping with seeing them as just people who did ordinary work.
No, that's right. That's right. And that's I always think that that's incredibly problematic, that kind of take on things. Because, I mean, yeah, because then it makes it really hard to identify where someone actually has been abused, where an encounter hasn't been consensual or whatever. That if you say that all incidents of sex work are non-consensual, it's all rape, then it's just, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't.
I think it's really unhelpful.
Yeah, it doesn't also make much sense, I think. But I really like also another quote. I'm just going to quote a lot of parts of your book. But you said,
I'm so glad you read it. That's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, doing my job. You say these stories are both extraordinary and ordinary, told by people who are themselves extraordinary and ordinary. There are, in some way, stories of great bravery, and these stories. And these are stories of the things of ordinary life too, of work, of parenting, of friendship, of money and of love. So it seems to me that, yeah, that the intent of your book was also really to destigmatize this profession that go beyond the stereotypes and prejudices that we have against sex worker and to show these people for who they are, which is people that have a life like most other people have.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really important to me to humanise people and to kind of tell full life stories. I mean, the book is mostly about sex work, but it also talks about people's early lives. It talks about the stuff they've been doing after stopping sex work, if they've stopped doing sex work. It talks about their relationships, travel, study, you know, other careers, whatever kind of thing. Yeah, so it was important to me to show them as whole, rounded kind of people. And I think that's part of why I chose to have them as first-person narrative as well, to, not to break their stories up into little bits, but just to have so that, like a person coming and telling you their story. Really.
Yeah. Mm. Also, I forgot what I was going to say. That's pretty bad. what was it? Oh, I can't remember. That's really bad. Okay, so we're talking about sharing stories. Oh, yeah. I was wondering, because it was also, I guess, there's this idea that you shouldn't talk about sex work without talking with sex workers, which I think is something that's very present in New Zealand. But me coming from France, we've got this union that I suppose is not, doesn't even qualify as a union because sex work is illegal. So it's more of a collective, I suppose, but who's trying to push their voice and be heard and say, okay, if you're going to make decisions that are going to impact our lives and our work, then we need to be involved in these decisions. And abolitionists tend to sort of like speak in the name of sex workers. And in New Zealand, you've got really this more open approach, which is to say, okay, well, let's have them talk about their experiences, and then when we have this feedback, we can sort of start saying what we can do with it. So that was that also the intent, is that to say, if I'm going to work on sex work, I obviously need to involve people who do it.
I mean, it's part of the sex worker rights movement. They have one of their kind of catch cries or whatever is nothing about us without us. Mm. I think disabled rights people also use that. And so I think it's really important to involve people. And I mean, the people who were interviewed all signed off their stories. Of course, I mean, of course, they agreed to be in the book, and everybody went through their stories in detail to make sure that they were happy with every word that was in there. And some people asked for a lot of changes, and some people were pretty much all good with it as written.
Mm. A lot of people that you talk to have mainly worked prior to the decriminalisation. They might have kept doing it afterwards, but a lot of the people that you talk to are a bit older. From reading those accounts, it seems to be mainly about sort of an era, an industry that isn't quite like that today?
Yeah, well, that's part of what I wanted to do. I guess because decriminalisation had changed things so much, I sort of thought, well, there's like a world that's gone now, that only lives in people's memories now. Not only is it a hidden kind of a world that a lot of people don't know that much about to start with, but it's also, it's gone. Like, that whole landscape has completely changed. And people are getting older. I mean, one interviewee died earlier this year now. I really wanted to record those stories while people were still around and still remembered them. Yeah, and I think there's just one interviewee who didn't work before decriminalisation. Everybody else worked before, and I think maybe three or four of them worked after as well. So it was quite interesting talking to people who had worked both before and after. Yeah, I know Kelly says something about that. You know, she felt like a weight had been taken off her shoulders with decriminalisation. And then Alan talks about he was kind of a runaway really in his teens, and he worked then, and then he stopped for, I don't know, 20 years or so, I think, and went back to it in his 40s.
Yeah, because he worked as a massage therapist, and then kind of just, I don't know, got over it, and then just wanted to go back to sex work.
Yeah, and thought, oh, well, see how this goes, you know, post-decriminalisation. Yeah. And it went really well for him. But he talks about being able to do it from a place of light. Mm. You know, he's someone else who sees it as a healing, loving kind of a thing to do with people.
Yeah, so I suppose decriminalisation has changed for the better people's lives, obviously. And then a lot of your interview, we talk about the insecurity that they would face before, especially street-based sex workers, and also how now there's, you know, the relationship with the police, which was really bad and has gone much better now. So I guess these accounts are also showing the benefits of decriminalisation.
Yeah, I think that decriminalisation has improved things hugely. I mean, the sex industry, like a lot of industries, isn't perfect and doesn't always treat its workers amazingly.
Mm.
But people are much more in a position to be able to take action and stand up for their rights now. The police used to be pretty, the police were going into massage parlours posing as clients.
Mm.
And then arresting the woman. They were going out in cars and entrapping street-based workers into their cars and arresting them. Pretty crazy policing stuff, really. Pretty unnecessary, you know. Victimless crimes, really, being prosecuted in this way and putting people in really vulnerable, horrible positions.
Oh, and there was also... And I was going to say, there's also the requirement to register to the police if you wanted to put an ad in the paper, was it? I think.
Yeah, for a period there. It started off with the Christchurch Press, where you had to register with the police if you wanted to advertise in the paper.
So you had to out yourself.
Yeah.
Sorry, keep talking on top of you. It was very damaging, potentially, and that has changed quite a lot.
Yeah, it absolutely has. And now it's much easier for people to work privately. So the street scene, and I mean, obviously people were more vulnerable working out on the street. So the street scene has quietened down a whole lot because it's easier for people to work from home. Technology's helped with that too. You know, you can have a mobile phone, you can advertise on the internet. That has really changed things a lot as well. Yeah, but the studies that have been done looking at the impact of decriminalisation have typically found that people feel a lot more empowered generally, and feel more empowered to negotiate over safe sex and over acts that they will and won't do with clients. So, I mean, that's fantastic, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's all, well, a lot... thanks to the New Zealand Prostitute Collective, the NZPC, a lot of the people that you talk to have worked for the NZPC or have some sort of a connection to the NZPC. And you talk about it a little bit as well, and you everyone obviously is kind of praising it. Was it important for you to put that forth as well?
Yeah, it absolutely was. I mean, NZPC has played a really major role in New Zealand in terms of getting this, getting decriminalisation through. I was particularly interested in just the story of NZPC. Like, how did that happen? You know, I kind of was vaguely aware that some women from a Wellington massage parlour had got together and had decided to set up an organisation. So it was really interesting to get to talk to Catherine Healy about that, about this bunch of quite bolshy, feisty young women who decided that they wanted to have more rights and started meeting in each other's flats and got this organisation set up. Yeah. So there is but there are also several interviewees that haven't had anything to do with NZPC, really, who I found, people that I found through personal contacts or where an interviewee put me onto somebody else.
Mm. One thing that the NZPC has, fought for has been the safety of the industry in terms of sexually transmitted diseases and HIV. And I thought, some of the stories touch on it, but it's still... it's not like a big part of people's stories, is it? Because the people you talk to weren't awfully affected by it, or was it just because, I don't know, it wasn't something that they put forward in their stories? Or
I think most people probably talk a little bit about safe sex, or in some cases not doing safe sex and then coming around to the fact that they needed to do safe sex.
Yeah.
I know somebody from one of the trans communities maybe it's Alan, talks about not practicing safe sex at first.
Yeah.
And then later on becoming a bit more stringent.
I think Anna talks about it too,
and Sheree talks about not hearing it about being a hippie.
Yeah.
And being kind of opposed to condom use because they were unnatural.
I guess it's there. It's just I think it was a really big fight in the '80s. And a lot has been done to like the NZPC fought quite a lot to get that level of safety. And it is mentioned, I suppose. I don't know. Maybe I was just expecting more people to... I was expecting safe sex to be more of an important part of a sex worker's life, but maybe it wasn't or it's not.
Or maybe I was just taking it for granted when I was writing out the stories. I mean, it's in the Prostitution Reform Act that sex acts, that you have to use a condom for sex acts. And the fact of HIV coming into New Zealand, well, HIV emerging internationally and then coming into New Zealand in the early to mid-80s, in a way that's the reason, I think that, you know, that's a big part of the reason that NZPC was able to get Department of Health funding when they did. Yeah, so they were able to leverage off that. They were able to leverage off government concerns about the spread of HIV. And the fact that sex workers were sometimes being scapegoated for the spread of HIV, NZPC leveraged off that to get funding and to build up the really good relationship with government that they still have today.
Yeah, and I think today's figures show that the sex work industry is actually very, very safe compared to kind of the rest of the population.
Yeah, because sex workers know, you know, and have done for a long time, that they need to be careful about this. There's somebody, I think, Misty in the book talks about, she talks about, well, the title kind of comes from something she says about, it's my body, it's my business, you know, don't you be coming and giving me some disease, I've got to take care of it. There's no way I'm going to have sex without a condom with you.
What I thought was really compelling as well in these stories is how the whole community is presented as very tight and very open. A lot of the interviewees talk about how, especially when they started, so the ones that started at a very young age have sort of been helped and embraced, especially in the transgender community. Everyone's been very, very open and very helpful. Also, it's very sex positive. Like Stevie, I think, talks about how sex positive it is and how welcoming it's been, and how much more fluid it was actually with a lot of like a big range of situations with people that, you know, had a penis but wanted to be feminine or didn't really fit in the category, like in the gendered categories or even in the transgender categories, and how everyone's been quite open about this, and there's been a lot of support. And I thought that was very, very, I was going to say sweet. I don't know if sweet is the right word for that, but it was very touching, I think, and moving to see that much tightness in this community.
It did. I mean, interviewing people, I did come to feel that it was like a real community or a real whānau of people. I think one of the transgender interviewees, Poppy, she talks about the transgender whānau. And how some people had been rejected by their birth families because of being trans, and so they formed a real whānau. And also in Sherada's interview, another transgender woman. I mean, I'm fascinated by her interview. As a young trans person, she was going into town in Auckland and wandering around, and she saw these trans women working in Myers Park, doing sex work in Myers Park, and for her it was like, they're like me. I'm like that. And, you know, she sort of plucked up her courage and went and talked to them and went and had a coffee with somebody and sort of found out a bit about what they were doing. You know, for someone like her, that was where she found her community of people, actually, and found role models and found out how to be a transgender person.
Yeah, and then she goes, she moves to Wellington and then sort of like recreates this community. Well, goes out of her way to find people from that community and then houses them and kind of like carries on this whole thing, which is
great. Absolutely fascinating that they had households. It was quite a common thing, you know. They had households, and one of the trans women in the household would be kind of its boss or matriarch or something. There's a thing that actually it's not in the book. I should have put it in the book where people talked about drag mums. You know, I guess trans people today would in no way use the word drag to refer to themselves, but people used to. And so people talk about having a drag mum or a drag mother who would kind of teach you how to be a transgender person.
It's interesting because the people that you've interviewed, most of them kind of were born in the 50s and use words that I guess wouldn't really work today. I think some people might find them quite outrageous, actually, and quite offensive.
Dana DeMello, who was born in the mid-40s, a trans woman again, she, you know, she talks about her friend, oh, my friend Cherie, who was a real girl. You know, I mean, people wouldn't talk like that today.
Yeah.
But I love it that that's in the book, actually. You know, I think it's really interesting to record. I've got a kind of a linguistics background, and so I love getting that kind of stuff. Really interesting.
I can see the historian part of the book, this side of the book where it's kind of like a. I mean, I suppose you could have edited it out and said, oh, that's going to be perceived as offensive. I'm not going to keep that in there. But it's also part of what it was. Like, I suppose, you know, what these industries were, how people talked and still talk to these day. And it's important for it to be there and not to be erased or polished by today's standards.
No. And you don't want to sanitize it, and you don't want to lose that, because again, these are voices, and especially people from the trans community, they're voices that aren't heard very often. You know, that stuff isn't recorded very often. So it's great to have it.
Is there anything that you wanted to say before the end?
I mean, something I always try and stress is that just that sex workers are part of our communities. You know, that they're not. They haven't got two heads. They're just, you know, they might just be the neighbour across the road. They might just be the person that sits next to you in your office. You know, they're just everybody, really. They're part of our communities. Yeah.
So we shouldn't fantasize about who they are and what they're doing.
No. Oh, and maybe I wouldn't mind mentioning. So the book is also illustrated with some beautiful photos by Madeline Slavitt, who's a photographer here in Wairarapa, where I live as well. And because I had some photos of people, of the interviewees, but not of everybody. And some of the people are in the book under pseudonyms. Most people are under pseudonyms or just under a first name and wouldn't have wanted a photo of them in there. So we weren't quite sure what to do about illustrating it. And so we ended up getting Madeline to take some photos of sex work sites and former sex work sites around Wellington. Catherine Healy got her access to a couple of brothels, so she photographed inside a couple of brothels as well. And her photos are really beautiful, actually. So it's really, they add a really, a really nice richness and another layer to the book, I think. I quite like how they represent things in a slightly oblique kind of a way or something, sort of hinting at something. I don't know, the front cover photo, which was taken at Funhouse Brothel, and it shows a pile of pillows and two lamps, and it's quite it's got quite a sensuous kind of a feel to it. You know, people often think the sex industry is like a really hard hard and dirty kind of a place, but that photo, there's something quite intimate and quite gentle about that photo, something quite inviting about it. And I love having those in there too. And then Stevie, I'm just looking through it, and Stevie's one is illustrated with a big pile of dildos, big pile of black and red dildos. That's what Madeline photographed for. That's in Stevie's chapter.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.